You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Cool. Well, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Just busy as ever, but, you know, loving every minute of it. And we're in actually 2 days, we have our coexistence bill in California that we're supposed to kind of the last Senate hearing for that. So I'm just prepping for that. And yeah, super busy, but good.
Yeah, it's impressive like how much you do. And like, it's always so official and you're like in the, you know, court and everything like that. So
let's talk about you. You do amazing things too. So thank you for having me. I'm honored to be on here.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I do less, you know, California government talking to politician stuff, I think, than you, but I do enjoy what I do. I just realized I didn't like actually introduce you at all, but I guess now that we teased that, who are you? And can you tell the audience like what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Manjali Rangdive. I'm the founder of Women for Wolves, and we are a conservation and education organization for wolves and wildlife, and also a wolf dog sanctuary and rescue. So we basically have 21 wolf dogs at our sanctuary, and we also do a lot of advocacy on policy, conservation work, and education too in the community.
I mean, it's cliche, but I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you is, how did you get it? What kind of kid were you? I guess I should ask.
Oh, I was a huge animal lover my whole life since I was little. My mom, she was a nurse, but she had that nurturing energy. So she was always rescuing animals. We always had baby birds or baby raccoons, you know, in our house. And so that kind of just started it for me. But, you know, as a 90s kid, you grow up with all of the best, whether it's David Attenborough or Jane Goodall or, you know, so many of our idols. And I think I just had always gravitated towards wildlife and animals, especially having a mom like the mom I had. And so from a very young age, I was a huge animal lover. Like, I stopped eating meat as a kid. I knew I wanted to work with animals. I just didn't know what that looked like in the beginning, but I was definitely I wanted to be Eliza Thornberry. So yeah.
Yeah. No, the wild Thornberries were very influential on me as well.
Yeah. 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. I loved wild Thornberries, and yeah. So just growing up, I always gravitated towards animals.
Yeah. I might've missed it, but what does your mom do? How'd she get into animals as well?
She's actually a nurse, but she just, she was so nurturing. She wanted to save everything. And she did actually start rescuing horses. So she still does that. She has a horse rescue near Santa Cruz. So she did that once she was retired and, you know, kind of settled down and got land and everything. But she was always trying to save every animal she saw. So that, I think she just kind of passed that down to me in a lot of ways, for sure.
Yeah. And you, I guess you're originally from California, or did you move there?
I'm from California. Definitely a California girl through and through. I was born and raised in the Bay Area. And so once I got old enough, I would volunteer at the local animal shelter. I worked as an intern at the Monterey Bay Aquarium for a while. And then when I went to college, I went to Berkeley and I studied conservation resource studies and interdisciplinary studies with a focus on marine ecology. And I actually did my thesis on sharks. So a little different from wolves and what we're into now, but still there's a lot of parallels there. So I stayed in California and my sanctuary is here.
So I guess let's just dive into, I have a million other questions I could ask you.
No, but I love it. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. You have a wolf sanctuary. I mean, a million questions there, but how does one just open one? And then what's that experience like? It's a big question.
Yeah, no, totally. So like I said, you know, my journey was just always loved animals, liked animals more than people when I was little. And then, you know, once you get old enough, you go to college, you get to study what you want. And then I did start. So I actually started my nonprofit organization. It used to be called Jaws and Paws before Women for Wolves. And it was for endangered species, just awareness and really uniting women and young people together to advocate. But I didn't think it was going to be wolf or wolf dog focused. I was just really kind of set out to help endangered predators. And then I rescued a wolf dog from the local shelter. And so that was kind of how I just really got down this rabbit hole of rescue and realized how often this happens, whether wolves, wolf dogs, or exotic animals in general, getting surrendered to shelters or getting confiscated by animal control. And most of them end up getting euthanized because they kind of are caught between two worlds, you know? So when I had rescued this wolf dog, her name was Diamond. I didn't know she was a wolf dog at the time. I knew something was a little different. They sure said she might be, but I wasn't sure. And she dug a den in my yard, and she, I would find, you know, pieces of bone and feather and guts and, you know, a couple little small animal remains in the yard. And I had rescued fostered huskies, but there was just something a little bit different about her. So I got her DNA tested, and she did have a smaller percentage of wolf. But I started doing research, and I called a lot of the local shelters, and they said, yeah, you know, we usually have to euthanize them because there's not enough sanctuaries and there's not enough people with experience. So this just kind of, she changed my life in so many ways. And I think I just got so set on wanting to help these animals because they are a really kind of prime example of the system failing and humans failing animals in a way. We breed them for our liking, and then people buy them as puppies, and and then they end up getting surrendered more often than not and euthanized. So that's kind of how the sanctuary started, and I started rescuing animals. My mom, of course, she helped me get land. She was a part of the cause in the beginning. She was really heavily involved. So once we did that, I just hit the ground running, and I would tell all the local shelters, you know, don't euthanize these animals. We'll either find a suitable home or place them at our sanctuary or another sanctuary. So we started doing that, and we saw some of the most horrific, you know, cases of animal abuse you could imagine. And instead of dogs, it was wolf dogs who were suffering. So that's kind of how I got started. And we were in LA, and then we moved up here to Northern California.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So when you said like the animals are, it's a rough situation, they're being euthanized, like specifically wolf dogs, there's that many of them surrendered in California?
Yeah. So there's not an exact number of how many are, you know, surrendered and euthanized. There's such a gray area there, but a lot of estimates say 90%+, like the International Wolf Center. And this is actually, sorry, that stat is for all of the US. So in California, it's still around the same. And this is happening all throughout America. I mean, wolf dogs are illegal in many states, and even in, you know, places where they're illegal, they're still getting bred. And I think Game of Thrones and Twilight, and like there was a direct parallel there. If you go to the if you went to the shelter, I don't know, 20 years ago, you would see a lot of Chihuahuas and pit bulls and you know, those kinds of breeds. And now, if you go to any shelter, you will see a ton of huskies and northern breed looking dogs. So I do think there was a big trend in having this kind of northern breed wolf dog looking animal that people really want. They don't realize, oh wow, this animal has really special needs. I can't, you know, I don't know how to manage this.
Yeah, no, exactly. I got Strider when I did. I got him from, I want put it this way, I had adopted several like dogs before that. And my cat was a rescue. I found him at a party. But then I saw there were puppies for, it's my Jon Snow. He's my bastard child.
Oh my, Game of Thrones. This was Jon Snow?
My cat was, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, that's so cool. I love that.
Yeah, no, he was covered in fleas. I had to like pick him off, and he was like bitty bitty. Yeah, I loved that cat.
Love you.
But yeah, I got Strider. I saw a professor of mine had a dog of like his breed. It's like German Shepherd, Malamute, and Elkhound fixed together. No wolf or anything.
Yeah.
But I saw in town that there was another litter born, and I was like, all right, I already did my duty of like adopting. I'll finally get, like, I guess it's not really shopping because you're not at the store or whatever, but you know what I mean? Like it was adopted from somebody.
Right.
But with that, he had his issues, and I like had only had labs and beagles before that. And now I got a shepherd from a puppy.
Yeah.
With, you know, his mom was a hunter. So it's, I had to really correct a lot of behaviors and things. So that's me going into it with, like, I love dogs. I know how to train a dog. And I was ready to handle something like that. But I'm sure there's hundreds of people, especially after Thrones, that were just like, I want a big dog. I can't do that.
Right. Yeah. No, total. Well, and is there is a big difference. There's a huge difference, you know, even with shepherds, and actually a lot of shepherds are a lot, you know, if you've never had a big dog, you really have to take the time to make sure they're getting the right exercise, their diet, their hips. I mean, there's so many aspects. And a lot of the wolf dogs we have, it's funny you mentioned those breeds, the elk hound, the Malamute, the German Shepherd. That is what breeders love to mix wolves with, because I think they want an animal that looks like a wolf.
Looks like one.
But acts like a dog, and it never ends up working out. They always have identity crises, essentially, because you have a wild animal that doesn't want anything to do with people. And then you have an animal that wants to please people. And then you have a husky who wants to run. And then you got a German Shepherd. So they have all these kind of conflicting personalities. And it's really hard for them. You know, they're really just stuck between two worlds.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And it segues to my next question, too, because with his breed and size and temperament, like, wasn't like I had a wild animal in my house, but it wasn't a beagle.
It wasn't like a beagle.
Totally, and like people were scared of the way he looked, and he was big, and like family wouldn't want to babysit him sometimes because he was so big, but he wasn't like violent or anything.
Yeah.
Wow. But with that, like I had, where's it going with that? He wouldn't cuddle with me and stuff. So like he wasn't that kind of dog.
Right. Right.
So it taught me a level of respect for him that like, and for a wild animal or a domestic animal in here that I hadn't had before. So you had mentioned your wolf dog. What was that? How did that manifest?
Yeah. You know, I had worked with a lot of different huskies and fostered a lot of big dogs already. I grew up with big dogs. So it wasn't completely from left field for me, essentially. And then when I was at the Monarch Aquarium, I was volunteering and interning with the sea otters and penguins. So I had been around some exotic animals. So I won't say it was a complete shocker, but it definitely was different. And it's exactly what you said, right? It teaches you respect in a different way. They might not always want to cuddle. They might want space. They might destroy your couch. You know, they might just want to run. And I think sometimes people get offended, or they think, you know, why is this animal not listening? And it honestly helped me love my other dogs even more, and treat them even better, because you realize these animals, they have their own autonomy. They're their own individuals. And I think in a wolf dog or a wolf, you know, you see that through and through, the wildness and really just that independent nature. So it kind of teaches you how to respect animals and wildlife and nature just on a different level, I will say, you know.
Mm-hmm. So now when you have the sanctuary and you're rescuing wolf dogs from other, you know, rescues, or it's people are surrounding them or whatever.
Yeah.
What is that like? I've personally never been around a wolf dog. I've seen one, but never interacted.
You haven't?
I don't think so.
Oh no. My gosh. Well, yeah, you got to come out. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, when I first started, like I said, I had some experience, but with a dog that's been abused, for example, because a lot of ours have been abused or neglected in some way. With a dog that's been abused, not all the time, but a lot of the time, with the right love and care, they come around pretty quickly. I mean, animals are amazing. Dogs are incredible. They are able to forgive like humans really can't in a lot of ways. I think wolf dogs are actually a lot more like people. It takes time. It takes so much patience. You have to really realize it's not about you. It's not about, okay, I could feed this animal, take care of this animal, give it the best possible habitat, life, vetting, everything, and it still could take time. And I think that patience, it's so important. And that's why even with our volunteers we've had, or even our kids programs in the past, and, you know, just different experiences, it's really cool to see the respect that grows from that. Because it really does take time. But then when you do form that bond, There is nothing like it. I love my dogs. Like, I love my dogs. Mm-hmm. I have a terrier mix. I have a Malamute mix and I have a German Shepherd, but there's nothing like the bond I have with the wolf dogs. It is.
Yeah.
It's different. It doesn't feel like a pet. It feels like a friend. It feels like a mutual respect. And there's just a level of intelligence, and you can tell there's always a wariness, especially for the ones who have been abused. We have one whose name is Titan, and he was actually one of my first rescues, but he had horrible, horrible abuse. He was beaten. When we actually pulled up to rescue him, we got a call from another rescue, and they asked us to go get him. He was in Stockton at a backyard breeder, and that's basically just when there's an individual who's breeding them without any permitting, without any regulations, and then selling them and hoarding, and they're just in horrible conditions. So when we pulled up to rescue him, the guy was literally hitting him. And
oh man.
And he had been chained to a pole his whole life. So he had like a collar that grew through his skin. And that's not even the first time we've seen that happen. Like, since then, we've seen it happen a couple of times, because I think people don't want to deal with their high energy and they don't know what to do with them. So they'll just chain them to a pole. So he had lived that way his whole life. And then when we took him to the sanctuary, you know, he didn't want anything to do with us. He was so terrified. But over time, he did start to open up, especially when we rescued a female. And then he fell head over heels in love, and mm-hmm. she was more friendly with people. And now I literally, he's part of my morning routine. I walk him and his girlfriend every single day. So it's just really amazing to see. But I guess like just the level of, they're more like people, you know. You really have to build that relationship. You have to humble yourself, and you have to be patient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you had said in the beginning there, like it was a level of intelligence you hadn't like experienced before.
Yeah, totally.
I think I almost verbatim kind of said that with Strider at some point. It might've been on some other podcast, but like,
yeah,
like a German Shepherd bond is its own thing. So I imagine like a wolf dog, it's another level, obviously. But something that I think other archaeologists and scientists do right now is like the dog genetics aspect. Whereas I'm more of the person that's doing like the anthropology of it, if that makes sense.
Totally.
And like how people would have perceived wolves at the time when they were being, you know, domesticated and all that. So I'm curious, part of why I wanted to get you on is your opinion on like having worked with these animals, like what do you think that might have been like for people back then?
Sorry, is my bird
I thought that was something coming from inside.
Hold on,
me.
I'm so sorry.
I'm relieved to know it's a bird.
Sometimes she bickers with the with the other two. So you said what I think about the behavioral, just say that last part one more time.
Yeah, like if you were to put yourself in the shoes of like ancient hunter, I don't know how much you know about it, of that, what do you think their first thoughts were in like an animistic sense, or like this thing isn't equal to me kind of thing?
I love that question so much. So I think, you know, because I do have the whole spectrum at our sanctuary, right? We have wolves, we have wolf dogs that are closer to a dog that might have only 20% wolf in them. So I kind of can see every level, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so I can just imagine, I do think with wolves, and I think I've even heard friends who are wildlife biologists or photographers say this, there's obviously a fearfulness because they've been so hunted and persecuted. But when you look at ones who haven't been hunted in the same sense, if you watch any documentaries like Kingdom of the White Wolf on Disney Plus, if you haven't seen that, it's really, really good.
Okay.
But that wolf population in Canada, they have not really experienced persecution. So they come up like with a genuine curiosity. And I do see that. And we actually have a couple who haven't really been abused. They just, their owners realized, wow, we're way in over our head, you know? And I don't want to speak for wild wolves. It's different with captive wolves, but I can imagine a hunter probably saw a reflection in a lot of ways, because I think there's a reason why they were the first animals we ever domesticated. It's different from a prey animal where you know they are going to be afraid of you, you know, mm-hmm. and the other animals that we've domesticated. I think wolves from day one did gravitate towards us, whether it was for food, like all of the studies say. But I think that a hunter, you know, an ancient hunter seeing a wolf probably saw a kinship for sure, whether it was how family oriented they are, whether it was just a mutual respect. I think there's definitely something there. There's a reason why we're all so obsessed with wolves or hate wolves. They instill such strong emotions. I don't think any other animal instills that level of like love and hate. You know, that's just so, they're so polarizing in that sense. But yeah, I can imagine. I think the animals that have not been persecuted against or abused, they see you like that too, for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a dog approaching you. It's like someone who's interested and someone who's intrigued. It's like we're intrigued by each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like that's a really astute way to put it, by the way. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Like remora fish hang out under like an eel, a ray. Is it manta ray?
Yeah.
And then like fungus and other stuff does like symbiotic stuff. But there's nothing like a human and a dog. It's just next level, and it's like so many levels. So
totally.
Yeah. Like I don't know where I'm going with that other than just a statement.
I have chills actually from you saying that, because that's such a good way to put it. It's like, it's not just strictly, you know, I mean, it sounds cheesy, and I'm kind of caught in between these two worlds of like science and sociology, I guess, or just dealing with people. But I do think it's not just science. Like, I don't think it's just, oh, the wolves realized they could get some food, you know, way back in the day. I think there's something deeper there, because you're right, like a remora and a shark, it's just so transactional, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's different for sure.
Much different. And then with dogs, like I guess it, in exchange for calories at the time, was transactional, but it has evolved into
totally.
Yeah, like the most complex symbiotic relationship I think there is, I mean, this fungus is probably more intricate in its own ways, but I mean, like the social stuff with a dog is crazy.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And with that, so since I haven't done or interacted with wolf dogs, I've seen wolves. I've not, you know, pet one, I guess, but I've seen them. And then interacting with dogs and doing all this reading over the years, it kind of struck to me, and this is probably more of your forte, but like once we leave the Ice Age and like our hunter gatherers, and even among tribal communities in the world, wolves in a, you know, tribal community, hunter gatherer sense, are usually seen with more respect.
Yeah.
And reverence and like brotherhood.
Yeah.
Whereas when agriculture comes around and there's, you know, domestication and goats, that's when you start seeing like the big bad wolf.
Of course.
And it's persecuted. So I guess, can you speak to that? You probably know way more about wolves than me. But
No, I don't know about that. But I deal with that every day, every single day. Uh-huh. So I can probably speak a lot on that, but I guess really I'll just say, I think, you know, that's kind of the common denominator with any sort of endangered predator, right, that we've pushed to extinction or the brink of extinction, and just obviously that change in lifestyle. And you really see how prominent it is across cultures, like you said. Just as an example, you know, we just actually got back from a coexistence trip, visiting some ranches up in Sierra County. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are having to live side by side with wolves. But of course, the mindsets there are very different than the tribes that we're partnered with. We're partnered with the Miwok, for example, and wolves and coyotes are in a lot of their creation stories.
Yeah.
So just there's a fear, of course, when it comes to a lot of the agricultural groups. But then when you talk to many indigenous tribes, and we work with many, we have an amazing indigenous scientist on our board. Her name's Dr. Jessica Hernandez. And just it's a very different mindset. And I think there was a kinship, and whether it was because of cooperative hunting or just learning from each other, you know, it was a very mutual relationship. And you just see that even today, you know, you really, really do. It's hard. It's something we deal with every single day. That in California, it was supposed to be three, but five endangered wolves ended up getting killed by Fish and Wildlife, you know, because of conflict. So that's the thing. We still have that mindset that they're the enemy when they were our first friends, right? So
yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot to say on that for sure.
No, sure. It's always like a sensitive topic to bring up, but I've always kind of described, especially what's like going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
Like, wolves, and I think you had mentioned this too, they can be political. It's either good or evil.
Yep.
Or it can be both ends of the spectrum. But like the wolf reintroduction debate, let me back this up really quick. So growing up in like Long Island in New York, there's no wolves there. There's a coyote maybe once a year.
Yeah.
lots of dogs. But then I would just be like, save the wolves, because, you know, why are they shooting them? Why would you do that? And then I moved to Wyoming and I met a lot more people who are, you know, ranchers or family of ranchers that are more sympathetic to the rancher side.
Of course.
I don't know if I, you know, a lot of their statistics and stuff doesn't seem to just, that's a different topic, but yeah. I understand where they're coming from, you know?
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
With that, it's like almost like a colonial or decolonization colonial thing here with wolves, because it's like it was their property or their land first, their area, we're encroaching, and now it's like, well, there's people that live there now too with dogs and children, so what do we do? And it becomes just like ethical. So I imagine that's the biggest thing you face.
It definitely is, you know, and it's a really difficult topic, because you can't just write people off. There are people who make a living doing this kind of work, and then it's a whole process. If they do lose an animal, sometimes it takes a while to get reimbursed, for example, or to get any grants to help with coexistence. But we do work with a lot of people, and we have a lot of friends who are doing the work, whether it's guardian dogs, whether it's range riding, you know, whether it's just different non-lethal tools. And they understand that 4% of mammals on Earth are wild, and that number is only going to get lower and lower. You know, we've lost
4%.
Did you know that? Yeah, only 4% of all of the mammals on Earth are wild. And
is that just because there's so many domestic animals?
There's so most of the mammals on our planet are farm animals and livestock for food. And then the rest are us and our pets. And that number 100 years ago was way higher. I think I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it was closer to 50%. So like, if you just think about how much has changed, right? We've encroached upon their habitats. We've pushed them to the brink. You know, they have nowhere else to go. And then we essentially take all of their food, because a lot of their prey animals are suffering too, right? From habitat destruction, climate change, fragmentation. And then we kill them for trying to survive. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of people who do understand that aspect. And it's kind of, you have to decide at the end of the day, do you want to live in a world with wild predators or not?
Yeah.
You know, you could just out predator everything, but I don't even think we know the consequences of our actions yet and where this is all going, you know, and just removing all of our wild predator cousins. You know, they're just like us. So there's like a lot there, and you know, we're on two different bills right now. We're on a bill for grizzly bear reintroduction. And that's SB 1305 in California. And we have a grizzly bear on our flag, but we don't have any grizzly bears because we killed them all, you know? And then the other bill
was
a
black bear.
Yeah, it's a grizzly. And then we're on a wildlife coexistence bill, which is basically to ensure that non-lethal tools are funded. So it's, you know, we're working like this is we're at the forefront of this right now. And we just launched a research project too to kind of understand what wolves are eating as they're returning here, and they've returned naturally. But sorry, I'm getting on a tangent.
No.
There's a lot there. And I will say it's hard. You know, it's frustrating. It's like you said, though, right? Like you grew up in Long Island. Like for me, I grew up in the Bay Area. We had chickens, we had hawks and, you know, coyotes and mountain lions get our animals, but it wasn't life or death for us. We were like, dang, we really loved that chicken. That sucks. But this is their land. Like, okay, I guess we need to get a better fence. You know, I guess we need to, but it's not so black and white for everyone. So we do have, you know, we do have empathy for that, but we have friends who are doing a lot with very little, which is, you know, really inspiring.
Yeah. I mean, the most common thing I see is the pumas in California, or the cougars. I don't know what they're specifically called there.
Yeah.
But
yep.
Mountain lions.
Yeah. They're all the same thing. Yeah. But
okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I see them in the news a lot. Like the one in LA that I think just died this past year, but
yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So there's still, I mean, I've been to California probably every year of my life.
Yeah. Know, oh, cool.
Okay. Take a few, but it's so, I shouldn't say it's so urban. There's other places that are like, you know, as remote as Wyoming, but
really,
in the places I like LA, San Francisco, Sacramento, like all over.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy to me that there like would be predators and like coyotes and stuff in there, but I've seen coyotes.
It's wild, right? I mean, so we're in rural El Dorado County, which is kind of in between, we're kind of in between Sacramento and Tahoe is like the best way to put it. And then where we just were for the wolves, we were in a very rural area in Sierra County, which is like up northeast of Donner Lake in Tahoe. So that's a very remote area. But, you know, in San Francisco, there's videos every other day of people doing their morning jog, like right by the, you know, Golden Gate Bridge or something in Golden Gate Park. And there's a pack of coyotes just chilling, you know. It's very, you know, I think coexistence is it's a really hot topic right now. And it's really important, especially in the next 20 to, you know, 30 years. It's going to dictate if that number 4% goes lower or not, but it's definitely doable. And it is amazing to see how some predators have been able to really adapt. I mean, coyotes are highly adaptable in these urban landscapes. So are black bears, but they get into trouble because, you know, they go and want to be in someone's pool, and then it's not their fault. And then, you know, they get euthanized. So we've seen them trying to adapt. With wolves, it's a little different because we haven't really seen that here, but I don't think they would do well in cities. I think black bears, even mountain lions, can kind of adapt. There's one in San Francisco the other day.
Really?
Yeah. Just on someone's doorstep. Isn't that crazy? Freaking
a mountain lion?
Mountain lion. Yes. Yeah. Look at that mountain lion in San Francisco.
Okay.
It's crazy. So, but right, wolves are so, you know, they're so elusive now, especially know they're hunted. You know, I think I can't imagine them adapting to a city. I think they'll probably stay in a lot of these rural areas, but it's hard. Obviously, a lot of people aren't happy that they're there and aren't happy that we're trying to protect them either. So,
That's kind of where I want to, and feel free to, don't apologize for nerding out. Like it's kind of hear it all. But I guess I'll segue though to the political stuff you're doing now. How did that come about from your shelter? Like you don't have a background in politics at all? And then let me ask that first, then I'll go to the next question.
That's a really good question. So, you know, it's funny because when I first started the organization, it was kind of meant to be for that. But then we went down the wolf dog rabbit hole and rescued over 300 animals, not just wolf dogs. And so then, you know, once we changed our name to Women for Wolves, we finally started to get back into awareness and advocacy. And we really kind of, I guess, stepped into the political and lobbying sphere when the wolves were
lobbying. That's the word.
Yeah. So in October Fish and Wildlife euthanized 4 endangered wolves in California that returned naturally from the BAM Sayo pack. And they killed, well, it was supposed to be 3. And these 3 were kept getting livestock and cattle in Sierra County. And so there were a lot of losses. And so there was a call to have them euthanized. But then they accidentally euthanized the wrong one. So they ended up euthanizing 4.
Oh, man.
And then they killed another one accidentally again in a collaring incident. So there's been 5 so far. And that kind of just activated us, I will say, in the California space. We started to show up at all the fish and game meetings. We don't necessarily have a background in politics, no, but I have this amazing mentor, and her name is Jennifer Fearing, and she's very involved. She's a lobbyist and for animal rights. So she started hitting me up and just saying, hey, come to this. And she really made me realize, you know, anybody can lobby and advocate if you care, if you have a voice. Anyone can show up to their public comments. And people really don't know that. So we started to mobilize our following and our community, and we'd get thousands. I mean, we still do. We get thousands and thousands of supporters contacting Fish and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, USDA. Let me back up. I forgot one thing.
Yeah.
I guess what actually first kind of activated us, the first catalyst, was Cody Roberts.
That's the Wyoming guy, right?
Yes. Yeah. But like, that was from afar. So we were doing some virtual, you know, advocacy and public comments in person, and all of the capital work that we've been doing that happened with the California PAC. But I think the Cody Roberts incident really kind of, it was horrific, but it really got the community together. I will say a lot of people, a lot of organizations stepped up and realized, I don't think people realized what was going on out there, you know, and what is still going on. That was just what was put out.
Caught on camera. Yeah,
exactly. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's, I haven't met a hunter, like, I know, sorry, his feathers were, I haven't met a hunter here that I've interacted with that, like, if I brought that up, wasn't like, you know,
totally.
Fuck that. But the fact that, like, when we would talk about it, those laws and loopholes exist where, like, he could still get off without, you know, seeing 25 years in jail or whatever he probably should have had.
Right.
It is rough. And it's almost, to me, like, I know it's different because, how do I say this? I just talked to the kids today at the school. I went to give, like, a middle school talk about, you know, what are humans, what are dogs, and, like, humans are primates, wolves are the, you know.
Right.
And was explaining to them that apes make nests, they make tools, and they exist and get calories on the landscape to, you know, survive. Wolves do the same thing, just without, they make dens, but they don't use stone tools, they don't do that. But that coalescence of ape and wolf together is really cool, but obviously chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos are, like, closest relatives.
Right.
But in the world of the animals, like, wolves are so social and similar to people in so many ways, at least for my, you know, not touching one up close, but understanding them. I just went on a tangent, forgot where I was going with that. But with that, like, it seems like we should, my gut instinct is that we should protect these things,
right,
and it shouldn't be as regulated as, or not regulated. So much red tape on it, I guess.
Yes.
As it should be.
I think that's like I like how you said, sorry, I just want to say, I like how you made that comparison, because I've heard a lot of people say how we actually are, I mean, how we organize our lives and how we organize our families and society, it's very similar to a wolf pack. And there's so many parallels there. And yeah, I mean, this is actually something I really want to do for my PhD. So I'm finishing my master's right now in wildlife conservation. But I want to go, I want to study anthrozoology, and I really want to look at, you know, that dynamic. How did that start? Where did this hatred come from? We talked about agriculture, but even just the hunting aspect, and same here, I know hunters, I have a lot of indigenous friends who hunt and fish every single day. Mm-hmm. They were beyond horrified, you know, at that situation. So it's just, it's so much deeper than just, oh, this animal, I don't know, killed my, like, even that would be more understandable. Killed my cow, right? They're trying to protect mm-hmm. their farm. But to go out of your way and cause so much malice, it's, yeah. you know, where does that come from and why? And it really is interesting. You know, he has, Cody Roberts' family has corgis, apparently. So it's kind of a fun fact. And it's like, you know, same species. Why is it considered a crime to abuse a dog, but it's not uh-huh. considered a crime to abuse a wolf or a wild predator? Wolves and dogs are the same species, should be the same consequence.
Yeah. I never thought of it like that. I like that because I think where I was going with the last thing was like, chimps only exist in equatorial Africa and they're in zoos or like in a primate conservation place. It's someplace you're going to see them.
Yeah.
But wolves still exist out in the wild where most people live. Right. Well, not most people, you know, higher latitudes. So with that, I think most people, especially with Goodall's work and going to a zoo and stuff, they can see why, oh, we should protect chimpanzees.
Yeah. Okay.
Way more than a wolf, you know?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I got you.
But it should be the same to
right.
me.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah. So.
Yeah. I got you. That makes sense for sure. Yeah. It's, and there's just so many layers to that too. There's so many layers to that. But I think people take wolves for granted. And honestly, the work that you're doing is, I think it's so crucial. And I know it's obviously it's focused on dogs, but I mean, this is the most relationship that we've ever, the most important relationship that humans have ever had. Like you said, it's the most intriguing and complex symbiotic relationship. I mean, definitely of mammals, right? And yet they are the most hated.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. And, you know, wolves and dogs are actually the same species. People forget that. I know I just said that, but.
Yeah.
Literally your you know, little Frenchie at home or whatever is the same species. It's Canis lupus and Canis lupus familiaris.
Yeah. People mess that up. So appreciate you getting that right. Yeah. Or they have their own different opinions on it.
But yeah. So.
Yeah. But no, I agree. It's like it's the same. I was trying to explain that to the kids today at the school. I've never given a presentation to middle schoolers. That was very tough.
it's a lot of fun and it's a lot of work.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Yeah.
So put a pin in that because I guess that can go with the next question. I was going to ask, or maybe it doesn't. I've worked with a lot of conservationists, a lot of biologists, wildlife, like contract people, academic people, and I know a lot of like fish and wildlife people or Forest Service or National Park people who I think go into it with the intention of like, I want to save the wolves and do all that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they just are into biology. But once they take those classes and understand wildlife management and like, oh, we do have to cull some predators or X, Y, and Z or whatever their opinion is. How is that the most resistance you find is like with,
it's a good question.
Like, you know, academic backgrounded people that are against reintroduction, or is it more like a rancher type person?
You know, it's,
it might be a difficult,
a really
question.
Tough question. You know, so I mean, I guess we'll say this, like where we just were in Sierra County, we were welcomed by the ranchers, and you know, most people would have never expected that. We're a group of vegan girls, you know, and we are, I mean, we're sad that any cows get killed, you know? So to us, it's like, we can empathize, you know, with them a lot, but they were amazing. They made us vegan food. They, you know, we broke bread. We had a great time. We talked about the landscape and how we can help each other. And I will say, I mean, sometimes like you would expect that to not go that way, right? But for sure, in a way, with the academic groups and the state wildlife agencies, I think because there's a lot of trying to, you know, appear neutral and save face, I wouldn't say there's like a ton of negativity, but I think it's really hard to work together, if that makes sense. So I think the most friction in a way is our state wildlife agencies. We just, you know, we started doing a lot of advocacy for black bears too. And we just went to try to stop the, basically they're giving hunters two bear tags now instead of one. And every single fish and game person voted yes on that, even though the science actually says that it doesn't support that. So that was really surprising. I feel like that was a good example. They all have fish and wildlife biology, science backgrounds. And I think, just coming up against those groups is difficult. And it's like you said, I do think a lot of them, they don't come into it wanting to do lethal management. Some of them do. Some of them do come into it as hunters who genuinely, you know, half of the council was like, they were avid hunters. One of them was like, I have bear meat in my fridge. So of course he's going to vote to kill more bears. But I do know there's some people who for sure wouldn't necessarily want that, but feel like they have to, you know, join in what everybody else is saying. I think it's a really complicated issue. I think lethal management is a complicated issue, but I just know for me, I think that it's more important now than ever. Like I'll keep going back to that 4%. Stat. I think it's more important now than ever to have ethics and science. I truly believe that. I think like we've been doing it this way for so long and I don't see how it's working. There's still friction on both ends. Killing doesn't build tolerance at all. Mm-hmm. You know, killing something does not make you like it. You know, and I know it's like, so I think, you know, I take the stance of I just think it's not necessary anymore at this point. We've done so much damage to wildlife and our wild spaces. I think we should be putting everything into coexisting. But I do empathize with people for sure. I know it's hard. This is how these state agencies are set up. And sorry, one more thing I wanted to say. Yeah. A lot of these state agencies, you know, you mentioned colonization, right? They stem from a Western mindset of management. And conservation in America post-colonization was established so hunters could hunt. You know, it was established so they could make sure that they have enough animals that they want to kill. And so it was already created with that in mind, you know, whereas with indigenous science, which conservation, I mean, that's not even a concept. That wasn't even a concept to so many of them because that's just, nature is a part of who they are, right?
Yeah.
So I just think like for me, an ideal world would be, you know, natives and tribes managing resources and wildlife again, because they had been doing it for thousands of years with no, you know, with very little imbalance at all compared to what we have now. So yeah, I think that wildlife management is definitely broken, but I do empathize with people who have to work there and don't want to do those things. Cause I know there's a lot of those people too.
Yeah. It's gotta be like an ethical dilemma to be in. And like we have it a lot in archaeology. Luckily our subjects are usually dead.
Yeah. So
it's
like,
it's not that, but we have like, you know, do we preserve this site or not? Or like, do we give this to the tribes or not? And like, yeah, it's tough, but it's not dealing with like the lives of living animals that are endangered. You had said, and I'd said put a pin in something, that you go to, you know, you just went to some schools and stuff too, with your group and the, is it nonprofit organization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the word. What are some things that you have been doing?
Yeah.
You know, what do you guys do?
Yeah. So outside of the lobbying and the advocacy and the social media, which is, we make sure to kind of stay on top of that every day because we've seen just how effective it is in mobilizing people.
Do you run that account, by the way?
I do. Yeah, I do. Me and my
it's like a prolific amount of posts. It's I respect.
Yeah, I don't have a life. I never see my friends or family, but you know,
same.
One but I'm co-founder as well. So we basically run the account ourselves, and one day we'll get an intern and really tap into that. But yeah, so outside of the, you know, we kind of have a few like, I guess, programs within our organization. We, of course, have the sanctuary and rescue we've talked about. We have the policy and advocacy work. And then education is also a big part of what we do. So we do usually 1 to 3 youth groups a month. So we have a partnership with the Boys and Girls Club, and we teach about wildlife and coexistence, even with, you know, critters in your backyard. So just kind of teaching kids to have an appreciation for nature. And then we do youth groups, whether it's schools, whether it's camps, you know, whether it's different programs. So really we focus on wildlife coexistence. That's kind of the main, you know, staple kind of concept that we teach, but also teaching kids about wolves returning to California. And and we do a lot of virtual classes too. So yeah, that's really important to us. And then we have our conservation and like more science research work. Like we actually just hired a wildlife biologist. So we'll be doing some work. That's where, why we're just kind of scoping out the landscape, but we'll be doing some studies on the wild wolves in California. So that's kind of a more new emerging, you know, program. And then really trying to work towards coexistence and non-lethal tools and see how we can help, you know, some of the ranchers. So,
yeah, that's awesome, by the way.
Thank you so much.
You've mentioned coexistence a few times. I know what the word means, but is there like a specific legal term for this or something? Or
it's funny because like, I kind of want to, like, I heard a friend of mine, she runs, Grand Canyon Wolf Recovery Project, and she started using co-thriving, which I kind of liked better, but coexistence, at least in the, you know, relation to conservation, is people and wildlife coexisting together without us, you know, enforcing lethal management or reactive measures. So really coexistence is being proactive about living with wildlife and living side by side with wildlife. But I want to start using co-thriving because it means like we both thrive. And I really do believe that. I think if we protect wolves, I think if we take the spider out that's in our house, you know, even just the possum in your backyard, that's what we teach the kids, that coexistence, you know, co-thriving, it is the future. And it's important that we teach our next generation that. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's excellent. I mean, it has to be. So I'm glad you're doing it. I mean, otherwise they're all gone. Yeah.
No, really. I mean, it's a crisis right now. You know, it truly is. We're losing biodiversity at, you know, unprecedented rates. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple more questions for you. This one might be, I guess I'll preface it with this. Like, so growing up in New York, I had the NYPD, I would never need a gun. Right. Like I'm a New Yorker, like whatever. But then moving out west and like I lived in the South for a while too, I empathize, I get it. It's fun, like, you know, whatever. The Second Amendment as a kid, I was like, get rid of it. But now it's like, that's never going to happen as America.
Right.
So my mind has shifted more towards how do we regulate.
Like, right, like right, stuff like totally, that. Yeah.
So in a compromise way. So in what you've been doing with wolves, have you found ways to kind of get across the aisle in that way?
I love that question. And I think that's exactly it. Like you're not, I mean, look, it, like I said, I'm vegan, I'm ethics first, you know, I ideally wouldn't want anything to die, but at the same time, life is complex. People are complex. Nothing is black and white, and change only happens if you're willing to meet halfway, you know? And so absolutely, I think when it comes to the wolves, whether it's ranching or hunting or just encroaching on wild spaces with development, you're not just gonna, you know, you're not gonna never have hunters. You're not gonna never have ranchers. You're not gonna never have crazy animal vegan, you know, tree huggers like me, right? Like we're all here and we all serve a purpose and we are all animals at the end of the day. And so I think it's really just how can we work together? You know, how can we have empathy for each other? How can we minimize suffering on both ends? And that's really the true nature of coexistence. So it's, you can't just go to a rancher and say, hey, maybe you should stop eating cows or maybe you should stop farming. Like that's like going to me and saying, hey, maybe you should just stop caring about the wolves. It's not going to happen, right? But it's like, okay, hey, how can I help you guys? How can we help each other? You know, is it fencing? Is it technology? is good guardian dogs. I think that's the biggest key and the biggest takeaway, especially in this work we've been doing. Like, you gotta, the only way that like you're gonna progress is by meeting each other in the middle. And I like that analogy about the guns, because like my dad is from India, but then my mom's family, they're from the South, and so yeah, I know a little bit about that culture for sure. And I'm like, you know, that's not me, but you know, my mom is she's the real deal. So
a nurse that likes to shoot guns, that's fun. My parents are nurses as well, but they were.
Love it.
But yeah, they raised me typical New York.
Okay. Yeah.
Like liberal family. Like, you don't need guns. You're like, save the
right,
animal.
Right.
Like,
right. Okay. Got you. So and we're then, like, how we're Earth. Yeah. We're like the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the opposite ends of country too.
Yeah.
But, with that, yeah. Like moving out west and living with people.
Yeah.
And working with people that have differing opinions, I think it made me a much better person, or at least made me look at science differently, I think. But also, like, even if I disagree with somebody, it's like, okay, let me try to understand where you're coming from. And yeah, like,
totally.
I went and shot guns and was like, okay, yeah, this is dope. But I want it like regulated, you know?
Right, of course. So, yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that was just a comment on the last thing. But, you had mentioned as well what you want to do for your PhD. And we've talked a few times, but I didn't know you were doing that. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because it sounds fascinating.
Yeah. You know, I'm still kind of trying to, I guess, like figure out the exact question I want to ask, if you will. But uh-huh. I like the field of anthropozoology. It's kind of, I feel like it's kind of a newer concept. It's not, it hasn't really been talked about a lot, but the way I see it is there's already been a lot of just strict science when it comes to human carnivore coexistence. And sometimes the science isn't always even relayed. You know, sometimes we're not even really listening to the science. So the science could say that mountain lions help reduce the presence of ticks, you know, in California, and therefore, it would be great to have more mountain lions or whatever. Wolves keep deer away from roads, like in Wisconsin, and reduce deer collisions by 19% in those areas. So like you could have all the science about why it's important to protect wolves, but if you can't find a way to understand people, work with people, you know, and how do you relay that information? Like I have a friend, her dad's an mRNA scientist, and she also works in conservation, but she always, I love how she phrases this and why it's important to add the sociological and anthropological aspects to this. She said, look, my dad, you know, he's an mRNA scientist, but if he can't convince people to take the COVID vaccine, then like, you know, it's moot. And like, I thought that actually kind of really just, that statement really, I think, shaped my wanting to do anthrozoology, because at first I thought I would just go into either wildlife science or conservation biology or zoology. But basically with my PhD, I want to study the past. I want to study, you know, how gendered narratives, cultural narratives shaped our relationship with wolves and how that paralleled with ecological collapse too, and where we're at now and how we can move forward. Like, how do we do what we just talked about and showing people that this is important? You know, we need to coexist, and how can we get people to see that on both ends? So yeah, that's kind of why I think it's important to study both aspects. But yeah, it's the program's at Exeter. So I'm like hoping to solidify that in the next couple months. I'm done with my master's in September. So
nice. I just, you can do PhDs there too. I forgot.
Yeah.
My friend just, the tattoo guy, did it at Exeter, I think, too.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Same way. He was just like, I'm going to get a PhD. Here's my interest. I'm going to just do it there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have thought a lot about going back to school and like for archaeology. But then the more I think about it, it's like I might go back for a PhD in zoology with like an anthropology focus.
Ooh, cool.
Like studying dogs and like their natural habitats. Like when I went to Mexico, watching them, like just like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I saw your photos from there. That looked really cool. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a great time. But yeah, something like that. Or I want to look at dogs like and like to, like known hunter-gatherer sites that had dogs. Like, what does their toolkit look like? Except my background was in tools, but something like that. But I all that to say, I'm glad somebody else is having that same kind of view on it, because it is the human-animal relationship. It's like studied, but it's, or it's known about, but it's not heavily studied until like the last 10 years, which is baffling to me.
No, so, I mean, when I found your page, like I was like my friends knew I was doing this today and they were like super excited for me because they know I've been following your stuff for a while. So like have such a unique, you know, focus. And I think it's really, it hasn't been looked at in this way before, you know, and it's so important. So you should totally do it. By the way, I did want to say, that little video you made, like it's like a video game simulation of the
like the Pokemon.
Yeah, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen. Sorry, I was thinking about that for a while. I was like, they're like, with the hunter gatherer and then like the wolf getting closer and closer. That was so cool. How did you do that?
One. Thank God. Appreciate that.
The coolest thing ever. Like I was geeking out about that.
Thank you. I geeked out making it. It took me 8 hours and I'm one of those people that like, I'm not going to let the likes affect me, but the amount of time I put into that and the amount of likes it didn't get, I was like shocked after putting 8 hours into it. But
it was freaking cool.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. But yeah, I played Pokemon a bunch as a kid and that was like kind of what got me into animals, because it got me into the, like kids that played Pokemon have a specific part of their brain that stores that for some reason. I don't know how much.
Oh yeah, I think I read that somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, but whatever that is, or you know, that's not autism. I don't know what it is, but whatever is like in my head.
Yeah.
That led me to like being able to categorize coyote, wolves, primate, like remember all those taxonomic words
totally.
And stuff.
Yep.
So, Pokemon was a huge influence on me. Salute. And then was playing it and was like, how would I animate? Because I like animating. So that's really all it was. But
I thought it was like so dope.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Did you find me, by the way? I thought maybe I found you.
No, I definitely found you. Yep. And then you followed me. I think I'm trying to remember when. I just remember you following me, but it was like a specific. I was like, it was before Jane passed. For sure.
That's
like
right.
There was something. Oh, you know what it was? It was around like the Dire Wolf time. The Dire Wolf time. Yep.
Yeah. Colossal has reached out to almost every like TikTok and Instagram zoology person that I know and not me, which I find funny. They follow
because
me.
Because you're too legit.
I know, I'm just like, you lied.
Exactly. No, literally. They're not. I put them on blast as well. So, yeah.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Thanks.
Definitely did.
Before we end, though, I wanted to ask you said you had dogs, and I guess about wolves too. The last question I usually ask people is, what does it mean to be human? And then what do dogs mean to you? And you can feel free to take a minute.
What does it mean to be human and what do dogs mean to me?
You can pick one or the other or do both. Yeah.
I really like that question. You know, I think that what it means to be human now is like a very different answer, I guess, than what it would have been back then, of course. Uh-huh. I think that humans now are so far removed from, you know, from our ancestry, from our authentic selves, from nature. You know, there's not even supposed to be a concept of nature, which I told you is a lot of the indigenous concepts I've heard is nature wasn't even a concept because we are nature, right?
Yeah.
Now we're so removed from it. So I think what it used to mean is, you know, being stewards of the land, being part of the land. Now we're so far removed. And I think dogs are the bridge. I think dogs are our bridge back to ourselves, back to the natural world, back to who we're supposed to be. Even a little corgi or a little Frenchie, you know, like we talked about, they are for some people, right? In New York or in LA or in these cities, that is the only connection they have. So I think, you know, I think that dogs represent not just everything we've talked about today, the most ancient and deepest and meaningful relationship with another animal, but they represent who we were. They represent who we
were.
Yeah.
Excellent answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I like that. I say that to everybody, but like that, it's just always unique and different.
That must be cool to hear. I got to go back and listen. I'm going to go back and listen to all that.
I should do a compilation of them because they are, it's always an astute answer.
It's a good Instagram post right there.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's part of the book I'm writing is like, I kind of end with a similar note. Like there's, whether you live in like, you just said the same thing, like Hong Kong or LA or New York. Some people, you don't even see a plant that's not fake in your day. Like the only living creature you touch is a dog or maybe a cat. And it's just this remnant ice age wolf that's like in your house, right? Yeah.
It really is. It's and for some people, it is how they got started, you know, in your field and my field. And it was, you know, dogs were the first connection to that and instilled that love. I mean, Jane.
Good, too.
Girl.
Yeah.
You know, like I love how she, of course, she talks about how her favorite animal is a dog, but I love how she talks about, you know, she used to talk about her dog. I think Rusty was her first dog. And that was like, that was it for her. You know, that started it for her. So.
Yeah. Yeah. She said like anyone who's ever had a dog knows like they got a personality and worth studying and all that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Rusty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to show you one thing because I feel like you'd appreciate it, but I don't know if you saw it. Just my new tattoo.
Oh, wait, hang on. It froze. Was that a Spinosaurus?
Yes, I knew you would know. Let's go.
Yeah.
I figured you would know. Yeah, I got it. And I guess I'll just tell you why I got it.
That now. Yeah, go for it.
I got it because...
for the listeners, she has a Spinosaurus on her forearm. Okay, yeah.
It's going to sound silly, but... In a lot of the work we do, whether it's the rescue work or even just the advocacy work, we see horrible things. And it's really hard to stay positive. You know, we get people sending us trapping videos, horrible, horrible things. And sometimes it just is so hard to bear that.
Yeah.
And I reread Jurassic Park recently. And then went down a dinosaur rabbit hole and like watched the new dinosaurs on Netflix. And it really had me thinking how, like, you know, these animals were around for over 200 million years. We haven't even been here, 200,000 years. And they dominated and they're gone. And I know it sounds like a little morbid, but it just kind of like helps me put things into perspective. Like, we aren't all that, right? We haven't been here very long. And Spinosaurus are my favorite dinosaurs. So I got it because it just helps remind me to like, okay, like it's horrible. Animal abuse, people hurting each other, wars. But, you know, humans haven't even been around that long. And it's, you know, we're here right now, but we just have to take every day and do the best we can. And Spinosaurus are really badass. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's super, not, what's the word? Cool. Don't worry about it being morbid because, like, you're talking to an archaeologist, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
But yeah,
I told so in my family, they're like, that's
no, I think it's cool. And yeah, it's like a blink of an eye how long humans have been there.
Exactly. You know,
it's cool to think about.
Yeah. I thought you'd appreciate that tattoo. Yeah.
Thanks. No, I definitely appreciate it. So many people sent me their tattoos after that video too.
I bet you have some cool ones.
Thanks. Anything else I haven't asked you if you want a soapbox on real quick before I ask for your socials and stuff?
No, I think I'm good. I really enjoyed that. That was awesome.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I enjoyed having you. We've talked before, but not like
this
at length.
This was awesome.
This is cool.
Yeah.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, so people can find Women for Wolves just at Women for Wolves on Instagram. And then our site is womenforwolves.org. So you can subscribe to our newsletter, get involved. And then my personal page is just at NANI. It's my Nani. It's my childhood nickname. So yeah, you guys can totally follow me on there too. But support wolves, protect wolves. And yeah, if you want to learn how you can get involved, then you can just check out our site. There's a lot of different action steps and things you can do.
And your sanctuary is in Sacramento?
It's like an hour north, but yeah, near Sacramento in Pilot Hill, El Dorado County. So,
okay. Well, if you guys are out there, go check it out. I want to come out there and see it.
You have to. You definitely have to.
I'm not afraid of them in any means. I just have terrible luck. So I'm always like, if I go to Wolf Sanctuary and do like a photo shoot, that's the day it bites me. So
no, don't worry. No, cool. They're going to love you. Right. They know the vibes and they're honestly cool. Really shy. So, yeah, no, don't worry. I got your back. Sweet. David, come on.
Well, thanks. Mm-hmm. And even if they do, it's cool. It's content. but I'm sure I know they won't. Okay. Well, Anjali, thank you so much. And yeah, people check out her Instagram, check out Women for Wolves. And yeah, I'm more than happy to have you back on. So I'd
love to
talk about more about your PhD and stuff.
Thank you so much.
Cool. Don't forget to, yeah, of course. Sorry, it cut out for a second.
You're good.
I'll make that seem smooth. Thank you. Don't forget to rate and review the podcast. If you're on YouTube, please leave a comment, like, subscribe, do the, you know, I hate doing this part, but yeah, please do that. And if you like this podcast, let me know. If you want to reach out, I have questions for Anjali, put them in the comments. And yeah, with that, we are out.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.